I make it a point to show all the photographs to audiences I talk to, and I've also given them to the Army CID and the Army Inspector General. Nothing has come of that, but I think it's very important that we bring home the kind of gruesome reality of war to American citizens, because it's so isolated and it's so sheltered in the American media, you don't get a chance to see the ugliness. And so Americans don't have a sense of ownership for that. They feel like we're doing all these great things in Iraq. We're opening schools and hospitals. And yes, on a limited scale, that's true. However, there's all these other things that go with it. And when you only see the good part of it and you don't see the price you're paying for that good, then no one can make an informed decision about the war. And if they don't see U.S. soldiers, you know, scooping out the brains of Iraqis, if they don't see people who were shot and killed for demonstrating against their living conditions, they may come away with it with a sense that this occupation is wholly moral and wholly good, which is absolutely not the case.
For the recent article on how the war is affecting Iraqi civilians, you told Chris Hedges and Leila Al-Aryan that you came to realize that most of the Abu Ghraib prisoners weren't terrorists. Can you describe to our listeners how you found that out?
Absolutely. After I'd applied for conscious objector status and was transferred to Abu Ghraib, or my whole unit was transferred to Abu Ghraib, I was stationed in the battalion headquarters, kind of working as a secretary and almost an officer's valet in the main headquarters. And I would work on the radio and process a lot of the paperwork that made the prison run. So I actually had a very good impression of what was going on in Abu Ghraib. In some ways, a clearer impression than the people who were working on the line as guards, because I got to see the big picture. And one day on my desk was this sheet. It was kind of a rap sheet of the prisoners and what offenses they had committed that had brought them to Abu Ghraib. And as I scrolled through page after page, I saw petty theft, public drunkenness, forged coalition documents, petty nonviolent offenses. And I thought, well, this can't be the case. You know, this has to be something exceptional. But then I read in the 2003 Red Cross report that 75% of the prisoners in Abu Ghraib had committed no violent offense at all. And the overwhelming majority of them, according to General Karpinski, the commanding general, had been arrested by mistake, that is, swept up in random sweeps or mistaken identity. And so my initial premise that, well, Abu Ghraib is terrible, but it houses the most dangerous people in Iraq, so what can you expect, was wrong. Because I looked on it, these people were not violent insurgents. These people were not murderers and rapists. For the most part, they were petty, nonviolent offenders, many of whom had been picked up by mistake. So when you had that bit of information combined with the horrible treatment, the numerous deaths of prisoners, the mortar bombardment, I just became morally repulsed by what was going on in Abu Ghraib. And I think if American citizens knew that about Abu Ghraib, they would be even more disgusted by the photos and by all these revelations than they are, because they try and sell you on the fact that this is war, and these are the most dangerous, violent people, and so we have to do what we have to do. But the truth is, the majority of prisoners in Abu Ghraib were not dangerous or violent, at least not when they came in. However, after serving 6 months to a year in Abu Ghraib, I can only imagine how their attitude toward the coalition must have changed.
As part of the process of you seeking conscientious objector status, you stopped carrying a weapon, and then the Army took away your body armor. Why do you think they did that, and how did you feel about that?
Well, I would have to clarify that. They didn't take away my entire body armor. They only took away the ballistic plates, the hard plates in the front and back that protect against rifle rounds. And when they took those away or when they requested them back, they said that it was because, as a conscious objector, I wouldn't be fighting, which makes a certain amount of sense. However, in the South, when they did that, there wasn't really a threat to most of us on base. Up north in Abu Ghraib, our base was under constant mortar bombardment. I mean, my room was hit directly by a mortar shell. So I felt pretty exposed and pretty vulnerable not having those plates. And I wouldn't go so far as to say that they were trying to, hurt me or see me injured. I don't think that's true. However, I think they were definitely sending a message that being a conscious objector made me of a lower status than everyone else, and that it was just a subtle hint or a subtle pressure that, if I were to recant, I would get that back, just like I would get back my leave, and they promised that they might promote me if I rejected my conscious objector status. So it was a part of a grand overture to make me recant my objector status.
And another part of that was how you were treated by your fellow soldiers. How did they treat you differently after they found out that you were applying for CO status?
That was really one of the most heartbreaking things about my tour, was that I felt like I had a lot of friends in the unit. I was popular. I could socialize with almost all the guys. And then instantly, overnight, after they found out I had become a conscious objector, I was a pariah. The guys in my motor pool, the guys who knew me personally, their opinion didn't change. But for a lot of the younger soldiers who didn't really understand where I was coming from, first they wouldn't sit with me, wouldn't talk with me, wouldn't eat with me, wouldn't go on missions with me, fine. Then it started to escalate, and it'd be the sort of, check you in the shoulder as they go by in the hall. And I nearly came to blows with another young soldier over just such an incident. And then later I was out driving stakes with a wooden hammer, and this guy came up and he grabbed me from behind and he started choking me. And I thought, well, he's just horsing around. This is the Army. We do a lot of horseplay. And then I turned and I saw all these guys standing there watching. And he was tightening his grip like he was really trying to hurt me. And all of a sudden I realized that this wasn't play anymore, that this was a guy trying to humiliate me, trying to hurt me in front of everyone else. And part of that subtle pressure to conform, to toe the line, to do what everyone else thinks or you'll be punished. And so, unfortunately, it came to a physical confrontation. And I felt that although I hated the idea of hurting this person or resisting this person, I felt that if I didn't do it then, I would be fighting that battle for the rest of my tour. And it would be a license for every other tough guy to come and pick on me. So unfortunately, it came to a physical confrontation over my conscious objector status.
And you did get a little bit more respect then after that.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the way the world works, and especially this military world, this hyper-macho environment where if you show any weakness, it just sort of makes you a target, and it perpetuates more violence. So unfortunately, I made the decision that if I didn't shut this down right there, then I would have to suffer it even more often. So yeah, I did. It kind of, the harassment kind of ceased after that.